Hey folks, this is On Science, the weekly podcast from the Science Desk at NPR News. I'm Andrew Prince. This week on the podcast, we'll hear about the challenges of cleaning up the ongoing nuclear crisis at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant in Japan. We'll also learn why the fear of nuclear radiation exposure is much greater than the risk itself. We've also got a great story about a biologist's search for hamsters. But first this week, we'll hear about the space shuttles. Back in February, Discovery made its final mission to space.
2, 1, booster ignition, and the final liftoff of Discovery.
April 12th marked the 30th anniversary of the first space shuttle launch. That was Columbia, back in 1981. NASA's aging shuttles will be retired this year with just 2 flights to go. After that, the iconic black and white spaceships are headed for museums, and their lucky new caretakers were revealed this week. NPR's Nell Greenfield Boyce reports that the announcement marks the emotional end to a fierce competition among museums across the country.
Former Space Shuttle Commander Charles Bolden is the top official at NASA. Today, he stood in front of Space Shuttle Atlantis at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida, speaking to NASA workers.
I'm proud to announce where these national treasures will be displayed and enjoyed by millions of Americans once the shuttle program concludes.
As he started to say that Atlantis would make its final home right there at Kennedy's Visitor Center, the crowd went wild. Bolden was clearly moved.
Thanks very much. I think I know what it does for you. You have no idea what that applause did for me. It's been a rough day.
He went on to say Space Shuttle Discovery will go to the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum, Endeavour will go to the California Science Center in Los Angeles, and a prototype shuttle that never flew in space, called Enterprise, will be going to the Intrepid Sea, Air, and Space Museum in New York City. These museums are celebrating, but Bolden knew he was disappointing 17 other contenders.
There were many, many worthy institutions that requested an orbiter, and only 4 to go around.
Today's announcement ends a suspenseful, high-stakes competition. NASA requested that museums make their pitches back in 2008. The hopefuls went all out to try to impress the agency. They've stressed their numbers of visitors, their historical ties to the space program, their grand plans to display the shuttle, while NASA remained mostly silent. Valerie Neal is a space historian at the Smithsonian. She says she thought her famous museum would get one, but wasn't sure.
This has been such a long, drawn-out process. I never felt we could take anything for granted. And I think all of us had doubts along the way because we just didn't know how the process would work.
Today, she was relieved and thrilled.
My celebration of choice is always a glass of champagne, so when I go home, I may do that.
Houston, home of Mission Control and the Astronaut Corps, could only watch with sadness and disbelief as shuttles went to L.A. and New York. Several family members of astronauts who died in space shuttle tragedies put out a statement saying the decision left them heartbroken. Richard Allen is president of Space Center Houston, where a crowd gathered to watch the announcement on TV.
I received a call about an hour and a half before the announcement, just as a courtesy from NASA headquarters, but I was asked not to divulge that to anybody.
Was it hard for you to watch the proceedings knowing what you knew?
Bittersweet, I guess, would be a good term. I mean, you know, when you're sitting there watching the faces of the people that were here with anticipation of one possibly coming here, knowing that that wasn't going to happen, it's kind of bittersweet to watch that play out.
Emotions ran high all day. NASA Administrator Bolden choked up as he told the chosen museums to take good care of these historic spaceships.
They've served the nation well, and we at NASA have a deep and abiding relationship and love affair with them that's hard to put into words.
NASA expects to have the shuttles ready for their new homes 6 to 9 months after their last flights. The final launch is scheduled for June. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
In the spring of 1930, a biologist named Israel Aharoni ventured into the hills of Syria on a mission. He was searching for a rare golden mammal whose name roughly translates from Arabic as Mr. Saddlebags. It may all sound exotic, but the animal Aharoni discovered can now be found in many grade school classrooms and children's bedrooms, running on a wheel in a little cage. On All Things Considered last Saturday, Linda Wertheimer spoke with Rob Dunn about this. He's a biologist and an assistant professor at North Carolina State University.
So how did you get on to Mr. Aharoni's story and his story of Mr. Saddlebacks?
I'm fascinated with the stories of individual humans and the way they affect both the living world and our understanding of the living world. And my general sense is that more often than not, these big changes we see in the world often can be traced back to the actions of individual humans with all sorts of problems. And so I'm always on the lookout for these stories.
What inspired Aharoni to venture into the desert in search of this little saddlebag guy?
He was a Jewish scientist working in Jerusalem. And in general, he wanted to discover both known and unknown species in and around Jerusalem and to name them in Hebrew. But in this particular instance, he had a friend with whom he worked, Saul Adler. And Adler had been working with Chinese hamsters as a model organism to try to understand the disease leishmaniasis. But the hamsters wouldn't breed in the lab, and so every time he did an experiment and killed them, he would have to go get more Chinese hamsters or have them sent to him. Aharoni saw this as a chance both to discover this organism in the wild and to bring it back from Adler, who could then breed them and make major discoveries about humans.
What they ultimately had to do was dig a giant hole, and at the bottom of it, in the little burrow, they found a hamster nest, and took the little babies back to the lab. But as you describe it in your paper, he kept losing bits of this litter.
These rare animals that were going to be so hard to find, and he found in a farmer's field, and so he proceeded to dig this great deep 8-foot hole in the wheat field. And pulled up 11 individuals originally, a mother and her babies. And immediately when they put them in a box, the mother started to eat one of the babies. And so one of the 11 was dead, and so they killed the mother. And so then there were 9, and so they brought the 9 back to the lab. And as hamsters are wont to do, 5 of them escaped from their wooden cage and ran somewhere in the lab and were never to be seen again. and so then there were 4. And the brother ate one of the sisters, and then there were 3.
Good At this Lord, point, this was a very brutal adventure.
I think it befits the Torah, at least sort of a Greek tragedy sort of story mixed with some Torah. And so they have these 3 individuals, and they very much want to breed them. And so, lo and behold, one of the sisters and the brother hamster have sex, and everyone is so excited that it's described as one of the greatest miracles in science of the times, that it's this incredible thing.
I guess those of us who've had some experience of modern hamsters would not think that this was so surprising.
It seems in retrospect to have been in the cards, I guess, or at least in the cedar shavings. but it's this amazing story. And so they reproduce, and they eventually produce 150 offspring, this sort of Adam and Eve hamster. And they start being taken abroad in people's coat pockets and official shipments to other places. And so the hamster that you might have had as a child descends from that original brother and sister, almost inevitably.
Why doesn't Israel Aharoni get the fame that he obviously deserves to be the father of the hamster, so to speak?
I suppose we don't think about the origin of hamsters as something that bestows ordinary fame. But I do think there are aspects of it that turn out to be quite significant to us as humans. And one of them is that the birth defects they tend to have lead to a kind of heart disease that's very similar to some human forms of heart disease. And so these hamsters have continued to be a good laboratory model precisely because they're so inbred, because of this original story involving Aharoni. And so they do matter to us in this unusual way, in addition to turning those wheels all around the world.
Rob Dunn is a biologist and an assistant professor of biology at North Carolina State University. Professor Dunn, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Oh, Harvey, Harvey, Harvey the Wonder Hamster. He does a bite and he does a squeal. He just runs around on his hamster wheel. Harvey, Harvey, Harvey the Wonder Hamster. Hey, Harvey!
There are times when it makes sense to be afraid, and there are times when fear can seem out of proportion with the threat. Take Japan's nuclear accident. Despite the fact that radiation levels around the plant are dropping, people as far away as Tokyo still seem at least nervous, if not genuinely fearful. As NPR's Joe Palca reports, the threat of radiation exposure does something to our sensibility that other threats just don't.
We live with a certain amount of radiation in our lives all the time. There's no way to avoid it, period.
That's true.
Of course that's true.
Steve Simon and I are sitting on a sofa on the 24th floor of a hotel in Tokyo. Simon is with the National Cancer Institute. He's come to Tokyo because he's an expert on the effect of radiation on health. He spends a lot of time reassuring people.
You get radiation from the ground because of the natural minerals in the ground. You get some radiation from space because of cosmic rays from the sun. There's even some radioactivity in food and water, very low amounts, and it's all natural. And we have lived with it for as long as man has been around.
So no matter where you are, you're getting irradiated. Take Tokyo, for example. Shinichi Kawarada is a radiation advisor with the Japanese government.
Normally, the average radiation level in Tokyo, 0.028 to 0.079 microsievert per hour.
0.079 microsieverts per hour is tiny, about 1,000 times less than you get in a medical x-ray. Now, that's before the radiation release at the Fukushima Daiichi plant. Kawarada's agency has been providing daily briefings on radiation levels around Japan. He says earlier this week, the radiation in Tokyo had inched up to 0.089 microsieverts per hour.
So the levels for April 5th are just slightly above the normal average levels.
It's true that some small amounts of contamination from that power plant accident reached Tokyo, but it's very small.
And Steve Simon says it's still way below the variation you get just depending on where you live.
If you live at high altitude in Denver, Colorado, or places where there's a high mineral content in the ground near uranium mining areas in the western United States, your exposure can be 2, 3, 4, 5, even 10 times higher than someone else that lives at sea level in a sandy area.
In other words, I'll get more radiation exposure when I spend 2 days in Denver next month than I got from the week I've spent in Tokyo. In fact, I receive more exposure on the flight over to Japan. So why are people so worried about nuclear power? Why do people back in America ask me, mostly in jest but still, if I'm going to return from Tokyo with a radioactive glow? Nuclear engineer Michael Corradini thinks he knows the answer. Corradini is a professor at the University of Wisconsin. He says even though the likelihood of a major catastrophe is very small, the fact that he can't absolutely rule it out
creates this rational, irrational reaction that nuclear power will always have. And that's simply a fact.
So even if people believe the reassurances that this accident will pose no health risk, anxiety will inevitably shoot up when the next accident occurs. Joe Palca, NPR News, Tokyo.
Now, earlier this week, the Japanese government raised its assessment of the crisis at the troubled nuclear power plant to the highest possible level. The rating was bumped from a 5 to a 7 on an international scale used to evaluate the seriousness of nuclear incidents. This move was based on new data on the amount of radiation released in the early days of the crisis, not on any change in the plant's status. The accident in Japan is now in the same category as the Chernobyl disaster in the Soviet Union. But the Japanese government emphasizes that the Fukushima plant has only released 1/10 of the amount of radiation at Chernobyl, meaning the lasting effects on human health in Japan are expected to be far less severe. NPR's Richard Harris has this report on the cleanup that lies ahead.
Even though we don't know many of the details about what's happening at the reactors, you can conceptualize the fight that's being waged. Lake Barrett, who coordinated cleanup at Pennsylvania's Three Mile Island reactor back in 1979, takes it all the way back to the basic elements of ancient Greece. They had fire, air, water, and earth. At Fukushima, it's pretty much the same: energy, air, water, and solids.
So if you go back to those four basic principles, what the engineers are doing in Fukushima is first they have to deal with energy dissipation, that is the cooling of the decay products in the core, and keep the core cool.
Over the past month, they've managed to do that pretty well, but at a price. They are cooling with copious amounts of water. That's led to continuing venting of sometimes radioactive steam. It's nowhere as bad as it was in the early days of the crisis, he says, but gaseous releases will continue to be a problem until they can shift to a better cooling system. So that's energy and gas. They also have a watery mess on their hands.
In the case of Three Mile Island, we had about a little over 500,000 gallons of very highly radioactive water in the basement of the containment building. It was about 10 feet deep. They're facing the same situation in Fukushima, but they have three of these cores that have severe damage to them, and so they probably have tens of millions of gallons of the same highly radioactive water that they're dealing with.
A huge challenge, to be sure. But Barrett says they were able to decontaminate the radioactive wastewater at Three Mile Island.
The very first systems we had operating within 10 days, and then we had a better system operating in a month, and then we had a better yet system operating in about a year to handle the most highly contaminated water. That water was all cleaned up at Three Mile Island, and it was safely discharged.
Fukushima Daiichi may or may not have any functioning systems to clean up its water, and there's no telling how much more radioactive water is going to be produced during the continuing operations there. But on the plus side, Barrett says there are large tanks for storing contaminated water, and more are on the way. And once energy, gas, and water are under control, what's left are the solids. Those are the most radioactive materials, and even getting to them is a problem. Three Mile Island was still intact following its accident, but the overhead cranes that usually do all the work were damaged by fire.
So it took us years to refurbish the cranes to get access down to the reactor itself. Then we had to lift the reactor head off.
In fact, it took 5 years after the accident until they could finally look inside the reactor, and they discovered that 30% of the nuclear core had melted. Still, engineers on the scene figured out how to deal with that.
They worked down through 20 feet of water for shielding with long tools and started picking up the pieces of broken fuel in the core and placing it in special canisters with vents and filters on them and put those canisters in a transport cask and ship them to Idaho.
They'll try to do the same basic thing at Fukushima Daiichi and its three damaged cores. Leo Lessard at the French nuclear company Areva says just getting to the cores is going to be much more difficult than it was at Three Mile Island. For starters, the tops of two buildings have collapsed, so that debris will have to be cleared.
A lot of that material is probably very radioactive, so there'll have to be shielding and precautions incorporated in order to be able to protect workers who have to do some manual operations in those areas.
Robots may be useful, he says, but don't assume that they can pick through all that debris. And if it turns out that some of the nuclear fuel has managed to leak through a hole in the reactor vessel, as some officials have speculated, it will be quite a challenge to scoop it up and put it into a shielded container.
In that case, you've got a tremendously high radiation field as opposed to having it underwater where the water is providing complete shielding.
He expects the cleanup to take more than a decade, and Lake Barrett says count on it costing $10 billion. Engineers can break it down to the basics, and they know how to do each individual step, but nobody's ever tried a nuclear cleanup on this scale before. Richard Harris, NPR News.
That's all for the On Science podcast from NPR News. We'll be back with more coverage and conversations from the NPR Science Desk next week.